Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
Support for this show comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Hey.
Sorry, I'll eat my snack now.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Weeds on the Box Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Sarah Cliff and Dara Lind. Got a great white paper for you later. But first, I want to talk about taxes, Donald Trump's taxes, his sister's taxes. We just had Pulitzer Prizes this week. The New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize for an investigation they did. They won an explanatory Pulitzer rather than investigatory Pulitzer. But yeah. I feel it was an investigation.
I mean, they submitted it as an investigation. So we in the New York Times are in agreement on this. And the Pulitzer Prize award committee does not agree.
I mean, they could have gone with the ER billing project we submitted, but maybe next year.
If you are a Pulitzer judge for 2020 and feel like asking Vox.com reporters how they feel explanatory reporting works, I think all of us are available. But
anyways,
they got old tax returns, not from Donald Trump, which of course is a subject of political controversy, but from his father, Fred Trump. And they were able to use these documents along with other business records to paint a really fascinating portrait of some of the Trump family financial shenanigans over the years. There's a lot to this. There was just like a lot going on. But I would say the single most striking thing that they found is that in addition to what I would call normal estate planning devices that were used to transfer wealth from Fred Trump to his children without paying estate tax on it, they did something that smacks of illegality. You can't know for sure until you have the case, but it's the kind of thing that if this were legal, everybody would be doing it all the time and there would be no estate tax collection. And this is Fred Trump owned buildings, mostly in Brooklyn and Queens. And he then set up a company called National Building County, All County Building Supply. Trump's kids owned All County Building Supply. All that All County Building Supply did was sell building supplies to Fred Trump's buildings. And then Fred Trump's buildings would pay an above market rate price for those building supplies. So in effect, Fred Trump was transferring money to his kids, but was not paying gift tax on it because it was being disguised as a business transaction. Now, again, as I say, like, to bring a criminal case, you have to bring a criminal case. You'd have to have a trial, blah, 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 blah.
But like, and there are statute of limitations issues.
Right. Well, there's that too. But I just mean like we're absent the statute of limitations. You know, you don't know until you try it. That being said, if this were allowed, you could just say, oh, I'm not giving you a $50 million gift. I'm buying your socks for $50 million, right? Like that would be such a
kind of the appearance of illegality stuff, right?
Right.
Like, yes, there is no specific crime that the Times report says. I mean, probably also for like defamation reasons, like the report says the Trump family engaged in. But when you have, for example, the President of the United States, or, for example, a United States federal judge, right, there's generally assumed to be a higher ethical standard such that anything you want to avoid anything that carries the appearance of illegality.
Right. But so then one of the things that they said in the Times article is that the statute of limitations on any kind of estate tax fraud would have long since expired. So there was no way to get like a real criminal investigation of this going. But some shrewd people noted that Donald Trump's sister is a federal judge, and she had long since taken senior status, which is like a kind of semi-retirement for federal appellate judges. And she hasn't been actually hearing cases for a couple of years, but she wasn't fully retired. And so consequently, you could still file an ethics complaint against her and ask for an inquiry into this. And there was a news story in the Times. It was done by most of the same reporters who did this original thing, except when they did their tax story, they like put it on the front page. They did a daily podcast about it. Like
there were lots of fun little like mini explainer videos, right, in the middle that, like, for those of us who, you know,
it was a whole production.
Right. Yeah. The Times made a really big deal out of this story. Like they weren't just like, oh, yeah, we did this. Like they thought it was a huge
something
deal.
Where when it dropped, everybody knew it was going to get submitted for a Pulitzer Prize.
Right. But then their follow-up story, which they put on like A19 or something, and it said that right after judicial officials said to the people who made the complaints, like, yep, full speed ahead, we are going to look into this, Trump's sister just suddenly retired.
Right.
And, like, and that
right.
killed the
investigation. On February 1st, they notify one of the complainants that it's being looked into. On February 11th, she resigns. On April 1st, there's an order explaining that the investigation can be terminated because she resigned.
Yeah. And so this, to me, is like, that deserves to be a big new, to whatever extent you think, which clearly the New York Times thought, and I agree, and the Pulitzer Prize Committee also agreed, that the original investigation of Trump's taxes was a big deal. The fact that his sister just like out of the blue decided to retire to choke off an investigation of this is like also a big deal, particularly because we have this big fight happening in Congress, which, like, again, everybody agrees is a big deal. And it was, like, frustrating to me, this, like, lacuna that, like, the closest we got to, like, there was no out here. There was no statute of limitations. There was no assertion of executive privilege or I'm going to order the IRS not to cooperate. Like, they had them. There was going to have to be an investigation in which documents would be produced, people would have to look at them, and poof. She retired.
But there was an out, right? Like retiring was the out.
Sure.
And I think, like, it's in a kind of larger context, it really drives home, like, how many outs you have when you're someone who is, like, wealthy and well-off to, like, make these things disappear.
Yes.
And I thought it was kind of – I know, you know, my expertise is not in, you know, judicial ethics inquiries. I was kind of surprised to learn that that is, like, one way you can kind of choke off. It seems like a bad rule in the larger context that you can end an invest. Like, yes, you have to leave your job, but presumably, like, someone, you know, you could see someone leaving their job to go to, like, a prestigious law firm. Or, like,
yeah,
there's a lot of, like, cushions one could land on, could choke off an ethical inquiry like this one and then have a pretty soft landing somewhere else. But, you know, it just drove home to me, like, how when you're poor, and we'll talk a little bit about this later in the episode, when you're poor and, like, the IRS wants to investigate you because you're getting an EITC credit, you know, there isn't really, like, an out. You can't really, like, say, actually, you know, I'll just stop getting EITC. Like, you have to go through the audit. Like, your refund is going to be held up. When you're rich, it's, like, it's kind of amazing that you can just, like, say, well, I'll just step down from my job and this whole thing is
right.
just going to disappear.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, this is familiar to kind of federal court watchers because it happened pretty recently when there were sexual harassment complaints made against a Ninth Circuit judge, mm-hmm. Alex Kaczynski. There was, you know, an official investigation launched. Kaczynski decided to step down. That rendered the investigation moot. Kaczynski is now kind of popping it. He's back in public life without the kind of social sanctions that might have been attached to negative sexual harassment findings. In theory, he suffered a sanction by feeling that he had to resign by losing his job and by lying low for a certain amount of time. But that was all, like, initiated by him and made it a little easier for him to kind of reintegrate back into those social circles. the question is, what is a judicial ethics complaint for, right? When you have police misconduct inquiries that are related to, say, mishandling of evidence or, right. you know, cops lying on the stand, the really big ones of those can result in the reopening of gajillions of cases, like including very serious cases that, you know, probably there was no misconduct, but because the officers who were involved also had histories of tampering with evidence, you had to go back and reopen this as well. If that applies to a federal judge, you could see massive amounts of cases getting reopened, you know, not just criminal stuff, but a lot of civil stuff as well. Lots of questions about, okay, does this only apply when the case is overturned, you know, when the case isn't overturned, et cetera. Like, you can understand why you might not want to open that trapdoor. At the same time, the insistence that an ethics complaint is only valid if it's going to affect somebody's future decisions on sure. cases, when it's an emphasis of past misconduct, seems kind of inconsistent with how the judicial system works. Like, you don't, when you are assessed a fine or when you have to pay somebody because you've lost a civil suit, it's not just like a percentage of future earnings, right? You have to pay money you have earned for a deed done in the past. And so there's definitely some frustration about the way that the judicial branch polices itself, which also
right.
the other
right.
data point here is Brett Kavanaugh, right?
Right.
Who there are in theory sexual misconduct complaints filed to his old employer, the DC Circuit, because of what happened during his nomination process. But because he's now on the Supreme Court, which sets judicial ethics standards for lesser courts, it's not really, you know, that's kind of assumed to be a dead letter investigation. It's not really that likely that it's going to result in his being forced to retire from the Supreme Court.
Right.
I think that forward-looking, backward-looking distinction is really interesting and important here. Because I also think of another context, like the jobs that we work in. If there's ever like a query into an ethical violation, one of the things that immediately happens is usually the news outlet will pore over that reporter's previous work and
oh,
start
yeah.
looking for, you know, and when I think of like the big, like, did they make up sources in other stories? Did they plagiarize in other stories? That essentially what has to happen is you have to get people combing over this entire body of work.
It's an audit. It's absolutely.
Yes, exactly. Right. So you're
it's
basically
exactly
doing
like an IRS audit.
An audit. And the reason you do that is because a news outlet doesn't want to have, you know, stories with fake names, stories
right.
that are plagiarized in their kind of body of work. And then you'll see a lot of stories end up with like a note appended, like an editor's note or taken down or those sorts of things. It's pretty interesting. Like, you do not see a version of that in the judicial system, when you could make the case there are a lot of parallels. It's like a big body of work.
Right.
That body of work is being relied on by other people who are making decisions, like with reporting. Other reporters might be citing that reporting. There are a lot of parallels, but it's a really different system for, like, for ethical investigations than what you have in journalism.
In defense, though, of not really taking the question of Judge Trump-Barry's jurisprudence that seriously. I mean, this was obviously, I think, in a good way rather than a bad way, but like, this was obviously an effort to get information about the president, right? It just mm-hmm. happened to be the case that there was no way to get an inquiry going about President Trump, but he and his sister were in the exact same situation, but she was a judge. So, you know, you could put the heat on her. I just think this is relevant for our understanding of what's going on. I think that there has been a longstanding question about what is up with Donald Trump and his taxes, right? When most Republicans did not want Donald Trump to win the 2016 primary, most of them maintained that it was bad that he was not releasing his taxes, right? Then as soon as he became the nominee, and particularly when he became president, every single Republican changed their mind on this. And that shows what they think is going on, right? They think that there is something that is politically damaging to Trump, but not actually serious, right? So that when they wanted Jeb Bush to beat Trump, they did want this information to come out because it would hurt Trump, which meant helping Jeb. But now that hurting Trump just means helping, you know, whomever, they don't want it to come out because they don't think it's actually that bad. They just think it's potentially damaging. Then on the other side, you have like the most far out Trump conspiracist takes, right? That, like, these tax returns are going to reveal, like, his 1099 MISC from Vladimir Putin, and, you know, and the whole case is gonna come out. And you know, of course, there are a million threads to that, right? Like, there was a lot of weird Trump back and forths about business deals in Russia over the years, and tax returns would shed some light on that.
And but, in general, much to the dismay of those of us who have, you know, who are in the journalism profession and very worried about going over our skis and who keep saying, let's focus on the things we do know, it does turn out with regard to the Trump-Russia thing that there are – that often the people who are jumping to conclusions end up getting validated.
But I thought this Time story about Fred Trump that – it's weird. I don't want to say that it was underplayed because, like, they just won a Pulitzer Prize for it. But I feel like it did not, like, enter the bloodstream in which people understood what this story was saying, right? It suggests, a, like, not that, like, there's nothing going on here, but that what's going on here is banal and that it's that Trump cheats on his taxes. That, like, that's what he's covering up. He's not, like, covering up some other thing other than his taxes and his tax returns.
He's not even covering it up, right? He said during a 2016 presidential debate that not paying taxes would make him smart.
Well, sure.
But I think this kind of, like, gets at, like, why it might be seen as banal, right? Like, he, like, I think there's this view, and it's actually enforced by a lot of the data that we have. Like, when you are rich, like, the smart thing you do is hire a lawyer to dodge your taxes. And this is a, like, status symbol. Like, look, they came, like, the Trumps came up with this scheme. And
right.
You know, I do, like, right. I agree with you. Like, I think it is a problem. But at the same time, I think, like, he has pretty smartly and, like, tapped into, like, this idea that, like, oh, no, this is just how rich people manage their money.
I think he's tapped into an idea that's popular with rich people and popular with the Republican Party, right?
Popular with wannabe rich people.
Sure, yes. But I mean, and then I think that part of – there's been a lot of – there was drama earlier. Like, Democrats said all through 2018, like, we got to get Trump's tax returns, right? And then there's a statute that allowed the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee to, like, tell the IRS to hand over the tax returns. So I would have expected that the day after he was sworn in as chairman, like, he was going to do it. But instead, there was this, like, months of foot dragging and public pressure campaign to,
right,
like,
right. It's tactical exhaustion, right?
Which, like, no, but you don't. But I think to Sarah's point, right, like, Chairman Neal has not been known over his many years on the Ways and Means Committee as an aggressive advocate of tax enforcement. And part of the issue here is that there has been a long-standing, and this is what we're going to talk about over the break, right? There's been a long-standing political struggle in Washington over tax enforcement and how tax enforcement works. And it's been a tug of war between Republicans and Democrats with some people in the middle. And the mass public has never really been engaged with this topic. There's, like, a journalistic effort going on at ProPublica to sort of bring the mass public to more engagement with this. And the question of Donald Trump, like Donald Trump is a great focal point for anything in politics. If you want to get people to pay attention to immigrant detention conditions, right? Like, the Trump link is, like, a big deal, right? And so by the same token, if we can have a public conversation that's not about rich people dodging taxes, but is about Donald Trump dodging taxes, that is a powerful lever to potentially reform how the system works.
Especially because we are dealing in an area, as that Times article indicated, where there's no bright line between, like, minimizing your taxes by hiring a professional and doing things that are illegal. Like,
yep.
It's not it's not like when your accountant is filling out your tax returns for the year, there's, like, this double red line that says, caution, you are about to engage in an illegal taxation practice.
Exactly. So, okay, so let's take a break and let's talk about taxes.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P.
Support for this show comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, or whether your team is around the corner or on another continent altogether, Atlassian software is built to help keep you all on the same page from start to finish. That way, every one of your teams, from engineering and IT to marketing, HR and legal, can stay connected and move together as one towards shared company-wide goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
So yesterday was tax day, and hopefully all of us got around to filing our taxes.
Man, I filed my taxes super early this year. It's so much better to go through mid-April when it's like, oh, it is that time.
But you know what's even better? It's better to be rich.
Yeah, because what we have been learning,
and so the thing we want to talk about now is kind of how the IRS is working, what that means for who gets audited. Our colleagues over at Today Explained did a really excellent episode where they talked to one of the ProPublica reporters who's been doing all this reporting, who's really been showing that what you've been seeing over the past decade or so, starting under President Obama, not under President Trump, is this slow erosion of funding at the IRS.
To be clear, this is starting under Speaker Boehner.
More than starting under President Obama. But also under President Obama's watch. So what you see happening is, and it all traces back to Obamacare, where the IRS was really one of the main agencies charged with a lot of the enforcement mechanisms in Obamacare. They were charged with enforcing the most crucial, the most unpopular part of Obamacare, the individual mandate. I remember during the Obamacare debate, there were a lot of these rumors during like the death panel summer of 2009, there were rumors that there were going to be armed IRS agents and they were going, if you didn't have insurance, they were going to like show up at your house. I don't really know what they were going to do after that. But there was a very specific rumor that was circulating. I think I wrote when I was at Newsweek some like explainer debunking it, saying like, no, Obamacare is not going to arm the IRS. Anyways, you saw that really anti-IRS rhetoric hit a fever pitch in early 2000s. You had the scandal around allegations that they were more closely auditing conservative groups and they're putting them through extra audits. It later was revealed this was just, you know, more auditing of nonprofits to make sure they weren't engaged in political activity. But there was a real political climate that made it very, and led by Speaker Boehner, very easy to cut back on the budget of the IRS. And so you've seen this reduction in budget, fewer people working in audits. And the part that strikes me as especially scandalous is that the auditing has really shifted to focus on low-income Americans. So the people who are, you know, most likely to face an audit are people who are receiving an earned income tax credit. You know, these are Americans who are by definition low-income, who are working, and this tax, they're getting this tax credit that is meant to incentivize working. They are much more likely to be audited than folks at the very top, where presumably, if you're just thinking this through on like a dollar and cents basis, as the IRS, you could bring in a lot more revenue by auditing, you know, the bigger companies, by finding, rooting out that tax fraud. It's a lot, you get a bigger return, you know, auditing people who have a lot of money versus going after people who are getting EITC. And it seems like it's creating a pretty unfair situation where if you're someone like Trump, if you're wealthy,
you have pretty good odds if you want to engage in tax frauds. Like, the odds seem to be in your favor that you might not get caught. Whereas if you are someone who is receiving an earned income tax credit, there is a higher chance that you're going to be asked for documentation that might delay your refund. It seems like a really unfair system that is, you know, showing the constraints of IRS funding right now.
I think it's not just a question that you might not get caught, but that even when you do get caught on the high end, it's treated the same as if you're caught making an error at the low end, right? I think there is a common sense situation in which, here, we're going to talk about somebody who is neither an EIGC recipient nor Donald Trump, right? Matthew Iglesias, 2 years ago, lost some 1099 MISCs in the mail, did not file his taxes correctly, underreported his income, got a letter from the IRS saying you owe us.
I think it happens to a bunch of us who have salaries and also do get some income on the side.
Exactly.
It can be really hard to tell when should we submit.
Exactly. I have dribs and drabs of external income. I do not have a small business, quote unquote, in which anybody pays attention to this. That being said, so I get a letter from the IRS. It's like, you owe us X dollars in taxes, plus you owe us a fine for having fucked this up. I write the check. I'm like, I can't believe that happened. But it's treated as a no harm, no foul situation. Like, I owe them the money, but it's not like Matt's a criminal, right? I think in a common sense way, if you are a guy who is worth $800 million and you have like a company that has a team of employees and a staff of accountants and lawyers, and you hire a fancy law firm to do all this work for you, there is a common sense way in which a like multi-million dollar tax oopsie is not like a mistake in the way that my stuff is a mistake. But the legal system treats this kind of thing on a par, or if anything, is softer on you for having a huge team of professionals that does this work for you, because it's not even your fault. If you rely on qualified professional advice of other people, you're not personally culpable. You're financially culpable if you get caught. I mean, there's ways to get away with it, but it's treated as like a kind of paperwork error, which combined with the relative paucity of auditing creates a very strong incentive to be extremely aggressive with what you are doing, right? And we handle different areas of life in different ways in this regard, right? It's like when you're driving your car, you're not just like not supposed to hit other people. You're supposed to like really, really not hit other people, right? Like, you're supposed to drive safely. And the way the tax situation is set up, like, you are not supposed to pay taxes safely. You were considered, particularly if you're a wealthy person, it would be a sucker's move to like try to really make sure you are paying all the taxes you are owed, right? Like
you'd be the one person on the highway driving this
limit. Right. The smart play is to come up with like the most plausible, vaguely theoretical, see what you can get away with. And then if it turns out you do get audited, and then it turns out that they say you can't get away with something, you say, ha, fair enough, officer, and you write the check and you get away with it. And that results in a lot less tax revenue than
I want to kind of tie those two together, because I think, Matt, a lot of what you're talking about is honestly a feature or bug of the tax code as it is written in legislation, right? Like, mm-hmm. We're talking about what are the standards for, you know, responsibility for tax fraud or a tax discrepancy when you have multiple people working on it? How should we be assessing tax in the criminal code, et cetera, et cetera? Because the IRS as an entity has to work within the laws that it's given, like, you could probably come up with some administrative ways without violating the letter of the law that they could try to do some more progressive fines. And then I'm sure you would see the people getting fined challenging it, saying that they're being illegally targeted. Because they have to deal with this, they're working with a situation in which they're not funding themselves through trying to get particularly big fish, which, in fairness, we often do see when you have, you know, law enforcement agencies trying to fund themselves through seizures, like, that also doesn't go super well. But they have a situation in which they know there's a certain amount of wrongdoing that they're not going to get to. This is different from what you see in like a local police department where even if you know that you're never going to eradicate crime, that's still theoretically kind of the goal. It's much more like immigration or for that matter, traffic enforcement in right. that sense. Like, yeah, there are going to be some people going over the speed limit that you're not going to get. And so the question is, you know, who do you go after? How are you at the individual IRS auditor level measuring success and getting people to make decisions about who they go after? And so if you have people who don't have the resources to have tax lawyers who are going to fight you every step of the way and who maybe they can't pay everything immediately, but they're at least going to admit to the wrongdoing, you know, first thing out, that's how you get a system where it's easier to go after, you know, the incentives are structured to go after the people who have the least ability to fight back. That is maybe like the argument that ProPublica is making is that that's a perverse incentive structure that can be directly tied back to the decision to not give the IRS the flexibility to, you know, spend some more money going after fewer big fish. But you can actually also see a world where the IRS has a lot of money and just decides to go after all of the EITC recipients, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think it's much more, I think we need to be thinking about how decisions get made about who gets targeted in addition to talking about, okay, maybe we just need to resource these people up more, assuming that if they do that, they're going to enforce this in a more progressive way.
Well, and I think, I mean, both things have happened, right? I mean, there have been legislative moves around funding levels, but also, I mean, there has been explicit political discussion of the targeting and the original flip in emphasis away from high-end evasion to EITC enforcement happened back when George W. Bush was president. And this was, you know, a pretty explicit directive that was kind of handed down on high. And, you know, I mean, I think to me, this ties into a lot of questions about priority setting at the FBI in the 21st century to guidelines that have been issued in the Justice Department that actually switched midway through Bush as a result of some what they felt was economically damaging fallout of the Enron and Arthur Andersen prosecutions. And to me, like, this is a really big issue. Like, I think the country has stepped away from financial crimes enforcement in a pretty serious way as a result of, you know, some stuff that's congressional Republicans defunding agencies, some stuff that's the judicial branch making it very challenging to enforce white-collar law. Some of it is anti-terrorism and now I think anti-immigration panic soaking up both like federal law enforcement resources but also just like mind space, right? Like the idea that like if one guy from Mexico is like roams free, that we have open borders, yeah. but that like if 8 million billionaires underpay their taxes, like we still have a tax code, right? Like it's just like a curious thing. Like the reality is nothing is ever perfectly enforced, but there are always questions at any given time of like, what do you have a bee in your bonnet about? And then there's like social norms, right? Like we have like a real culture in the United States of like bragging about underpaying your taxes. I mean, I know journalists who like talk about how great some particular accountant is because he like finds all this stuff for them. And I said, it's like, you know, I mean, like anyone, you don't need a talented accountant to tell you to claim deductions that you aren't really eligible for and then hope you can get away with it.
No, but you like you kind of just want the accountant as like the middle space between you doing
right.
it. And so it's like that plausible deniability. And I feel like
but I just mean like these are – I hear this from good yes. people who would not tell me about like how they found out with this amazing way to steal cars and get away with it because like it's morally wrong, right?
Well, and like, I mean, this also is like a system of our own making, right? Like this all comes back to like creating a tax code that creates these gray areas that one can take advantage of. Like, you know, the idea of claiming a home office, for example, like it's like a gray area that like I do public speaking, like I can uh-huh. claim that, you know, I don't, it is set up in a way that encourages like finding loopholes. Like if you read like T.R. Reid came out with a good book a year mm-hmm. or two ago called The Fine Mess that looks at how international tax schemes work. And one of the things he drives home is the complexity of ours. I mean, that is a feature of it. That is a feature that lets you find these like loopholes and ways to like dodge and bring down your overall marginal rate. We could change that. Like one thing we could do is make the tax code a lot simpler. And that would, you know, mean for someone with EITC, it'd be a lot harder to get caught up in like not having the right paperwork of being like short this or that. For people on the high end, it would mean there are just less places to, you know, find these loopholes in the system. But, you know, we did taxes form in 2017. It wasn't really about simplifying the tax code in any way. But the complexity seems to both benefit the wealthy and disadvantage the low income.
It's a concentrated benefit.
Right.
It diffuse harm problem, which is, you know, one of the classic public policy problems. And the other thing here is that it creates an industry that is going to lobby for that complicated
TurboTax.
Which is the other wild thing that ProPublica's like last week came out talking about how there was a bill in Congress that would make it illegal for the IRS to provide like free automatic tax filing because the tax preparation industry would be so disadvantaged by this that they were lobbying against it. And, you know, we've also done reporting on how there's TurboTax and et cetera keep lobbying for the continued complexity of the tax code because the more people who can do their own taxes, the less revenue they get. Like, there's definitely you would have to have a lot of members of Congress, A, deciding that it's not – that whatever personal benefit they get in the complexity of the tax code as wealthy people who have legal expertise at their fingertips is not worth it, and B, that they are willing to harm these particular people who are going to step into their offices in order to help a bunch of people who are not equipped to lobby – like, there's no big EITC tax audit lobby day. Right? Like, that's not something where you have anything more than a couple of ProPublica stories and Center on Budget and Policy Priorities white papers that are going to be telling you, hey, maybe the status quo is a bad idea.
I want to distinguish between two things, though, here, which comes up all the time. One is the complexity of the actual tax code. The other is the complexity of the tax filing process, right? Because one of the things that in the mix here, right, is that in a normal country, the way you would file taxes is the same way that – like, I was telling the story a couple years ago. I underpaid my taxes because I missed some 1099s in the mail.
We're totally
right?
all going to get audited after this episode.
The IRS caught me because the IRS knows how much
this
taxes I
This is the thing
I
that
owe.
Drives me bananas is they know how much money I
right.
am earning.
And so
it's the world's biggest merit system.
And so the way Japan, many other countries, and it's frequently been proposed, is the IRS would just do the thing that it used to catch me having
exactly.
underpaid my taxes – and would just tell me how much taxes I owe.
And you
right?
could dispute it if you thought they were wrong. But generally, and, like, the government is good
yes,
at keeping track
and,
of these
and,
things.
And, right, exactly. It would go the other way.
Yes.
If you were – and I think that that would not only be simpler for people, this would shift the norm.
Yes.
Because then if you wanted to go make a really aggressive home office claim, you would have to say, no, IRS, I am choosing to dispute this. I am going to go fill out all the forms myself and go make this claim. You might get away with it. But it's because now, no matter how timid you would like to be, you have to go through all the hoops. It like psychologically, emotionally, in terms of norms, makes it seem like, okay, as long as I'm in here doing this work, like I ought to find the deductions that I can go claim, right? And this is the lobbying thing. This is not like the IRS is dumb or nobody knows this or, why are these bureaucrats such dummies? Like the reason is like many politicians have proposed legislation to have the IRS autocomplete people's forms. This would really take care of the EITC thing because the EITC is very complicated.
Right, right.
But
like,
it's not.
If you're in voluntary circles, the beginning of every year, there's a big push like, hey, can you like do some training and be a volunteer to help people who qualify for the EITC
right.
fill out their taxes? Because it's not something that most people can do on their own.
And the formula is complicated. Like I right now could not explain it to you because it's complicated. That being said, like the IRS could just do it. Right. The complexity stems from the way it phases in and phases out and has to do with how many children you have and yada, yada, yada. Like they could handle all of that stuff. And then that would leave you, right? If you crush the power of the TurboTax lobby, you have the taxes done automatically. That would leave you with rich people who have inherently complex tax situations because they are running businesses, right? In which case, the IRS can't just simply check the box. But then that would be the reasonable place to target the bulk of your enforcement, right? You would be saying, look, this is complicated. You're doing it yourself. You're working with lawyers and accountants. But then, like, the IRS would have, like, smart human beings going after that, right? And you would have a much less normalized situation in which middle-class people look with pride, beaming pride, on their, like, little random deduction scams. And then, like, rich people are sneaking off with millions of dollars in underpaid taxes. And that, I think, is, like, at the center of what's going on with Donald Trump. It is fairly normal to have affluent people in the White House, but we have not since, like, the old days of, like, the slave plantation owners had, like, an actual business operator in the White House. And if scrutiny is put into just, like, how it is that business operators do their taxes, like, I think people would be outraged and would demand changes.
Well, one thing I think is notable that one of the things in the Trump budget was suggesting increasing the IRS's budget. One thing I would be concerned about there is, like, where do those resources get deployed? You could see a situation where they decide, okay, we're going to audit every EITC recipient because, you know, there's this growing rhetoric around the importance of work and low-income people should work for the benefits that they receive. You see this in Medicaid work requirements. It's a big part of the, you know, critique of EITC is people trying to game the system, trying to get tax credits they don't deserve. So you could see one world where the IRS staffs up and they take on big companies and they do those investigations, which are quite challenging and politically would probably face a lot of blowback from companies who are not thrilled to be audited and would certainly let their congressional delegation know about it. Or, you know, you could use those new resources to set up even more aggressive audits of EITC. And you could see this more politicized version of the IRS that kind of is like where they put their auditing energy could depend a lot on who is in charge and how they're being directed to do
someday
that.
We should talk about how we should replace the EITC with something better that does not actually put this weight on individuals.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I was also going to just throw out there that in a period where we had this big law school glut during the recession, yes, and there are now a lot of overeducated people with JDs who can't find careers in law, tax law is a notoriously boring, but generally fairly lucrative, but, like, obviously complex enough that people actually need some preparation in it, area of law. And maybe if we had a situation where there were was more incentive for companies and businessmen to hire compliance-focused tax attorneys. Ooh. People who find tax law otherwise immoral might be incentivized to find jobs that they're actually legally qualified for instead of just having a bunch of JDs.
This is like the Daryl Lynn, like, AmeriCorps for lawyers.
Yeah.
I like this.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So let's take a break and then let's talk about law on the streets.
Okay, Dara, what's our paper today?
Right. So this is a paper from PNAS, which is the Proceedings in the National Academies of Science, from a bunch of NYU researchers out of the Center for Policing Equity, which is run by Phil Goff. It's a study, four waves of surveys of non-white teen boys, mostly Black and Latino, across four high schools in some southern city in the U.S. It does the thing that you see a lot in sociology where it doesn't name the city. It doesn't do the thing you see in a lot of sociology where it's easy to name the city anyway. But, like, it does not appear to be the case that this is super specific to this particular city. And what they did was they asked them every 6 months for 2 years, from fall of their ninth grade year to spring of their 10th grade year, a bunch of questions about whether they'd been stopped by police, like pedestrian stops, not stopped in their cars, but, like, just walking through the street, kind of stop and frisk kind of stuff, and a bunch of questions about behavior and feelings and that sort of thing. The reason for this is that there's a consensus in the criminology literature that the best thing you can do for crime is to proactively put a bunch of policemen in high crime areas and to make sure that they're being very visible and having a lot of contacts with people who might be more likely to engage in crimes. And generally, that does tend to bring crime rates down, but people have started to raise questions about how does this work in the other direction? What happens after somebody who has not committed a crime gets stopped by police?
And the results of this study validate a theoretical model that some of the kind of juvenile crime research has pointed to, that after somebody who has not done anything delinquent after somebody gets stopped by police, that increases their psychological distress down the road, which in turn increases future delinquency. The kind of fundamental finding here is that having been stopped by police in one wave of the study predicted future delinquent behaviors, and that did not work the other way. Being more likely to report delinquent behaviors in one phase did not mean you were more likely to get stopped by police. In fact, generally, police were not more likely to stop the boys in the study who reported delinquent behaviors than the boys in the study who didn't. So it's a big challenge to the idea that we've solved the problem of urban policing, because in addition to these kind of general problems of, okay, what are we doing to, you know, what does the school-to-prison pipeline do to future academic achievement? What are we doing to non-white boys when we label them as criminals? This raises the possibility that proactive policing, as it's generally applied, could actually be increasing crime rates down the road.
So I felt, though, that actually John McDonald, Jeffrey Fagan, and Amanda Geller did solve urban policing in their 2016 article, The Effects of Local Police Surges on Crime and Arrests in New York City, in which they found that sending extra police officers to a neighborhood reduced crime there, and that stopping people had no incremental crime-reducing impact over and above the impact of sending the people there, right? So basically, they looked at which neighborhoods got a surge in cops. They found that the surge reduced crime. Then they looked in the surges, like who did a lot of stops versus who was lazy. And they found that doing the stops didn't change anything, that it was just being there, right? It can sometimes sound a little bit paradoxical in a weird way. Like there's some good papers by Richard Rosenfeld on like the most dopey form of hotspot policing, which is like literally one particular block has had a lot of crime on it. And what if you just send
an intersection?
Right, right. So it's like, what if you just send a cop to that intersection? And like, DC was doing this for a little while. I was like, this is the dumbest thing ever. Like they'll just do the crime around the corner. But they don't. There's not like 100% non-displacement, but like it's not nothing either. And it's sort of along the lines, I would say, of like the security guards you see at the CVS. When if you kind of think about it, it's like, what are those guys really going to do, right? Like nothing. But private companies feel that just putting somebody in the security guard uniform and having them kind of sit there, you know, is going to cut down on shoplifting. And it seems like having police officers just out and about, you know, like they're there, they're in their uniforms, people can see them, and they think, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't do any crimes, that reduces crime, and that hassling people generates a lot of ill will. But like, you don't need to hassle people. You could just stand there.
Well, yeah. I think an interesting thing I'd love to see more research on in the space is like what those interactions are like, because you can imagine like very different versions of like, hey, how's it going on your way to school, versus like a more confrontational, like more aggressive, like, where are you going? Where are you coming from? Like, those are small, and I imagine they're quite challenging to study, but they seem like they would, you know, create very different versions of what might be coded the same in the research of something that is an interaction or a stop could be felt very, very different ways depending on what the actual substance of that interaction is like. If it's like a accusatorial, like you seem to be doing something wrong, versus a like you actually know the kids and you know you're, you know, wondering about how their sibling is. Like you could see that kind of like version of community policing, or you could see that version of starting from like the viewpoint that this person has probably done something wrong.
Yeah, there actually is a little bit of such research in the context of stops in particular. The concept is called procedural justice, that if after a given interaction, you know, somebody is treated with respect, if things are explained to them, if they feel that they're not kind of being coerced into doing things, that they'll come away feeling that even if they were ultimately, you know, given a ticket or whatever, that justice was done, they'll like feel good about the interaction. The problem with that is that
it's very, very fragile. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to break the perceived legitimacy of law enforcement as an entity. And when we're talking about like teenage boys, I mean, one of the most depressing stuff about this study is A, the research limitations of just how difficult it is to get several hundred ninth and 10th grade boys to continue to participate in studies when like they're not necessarily going to continue to show up to school. Their parents, you know, they can't necessarily get their parents to return the parental consent forms within 2 days. The people who were most likely to drop out of the study were the ones who were most likely to report having been stopped by police in the first wave. So like there is an argument that this is a kind of conservative study, but also this was measuring 14 and 15 year old boys. Previous studies have shown that the average age of first police stop is 12, which is just it makes it
sorry.
Really,
that's an average for which population?
For non-white boys.
Oh, for okay, great.
Who are disproportionately the most over-policed.
Sure.
And you know that at a certain point, that really challenges not just how we think of the kinds of kids who are likely to be delinquent. You know, the subset of kids who are getting stopped, but also if you know at 12, you're not necessarily. You can't necessarily decide to hang with a quote-unquote good crowd, right? Like if the kids you hang out with from the neighborhood, some of them are already getting stopped, even if you yourself are not getting stopped, that's going to affect the perceived legitimacy of the police as an institution. And so I think that the idea of having cops just stand there or having them engage in positive interactions is really hard to – you can't wipe the slate clean on this, right? You can't just say tomorrow we'll have the cops stop doing things, not least because – you can't control what individual law enforcement officers do, and there's a real, you know, there's a morale problem, which we've gotten to in the podcast before, with having law enforcement officers being told the thing you think is your job is bad. But also, you can't just have a police officer stand there and not stop boys, and next week the boys are like, ah, this is cool. I don't feel like I've been labeled a criminal anymore.
I don't know. I think there's like a lot of stuff going on here, right? But like there was a big push. Who knows what was going on in this large southern city, right? But like in New York, there was a specific push, like a big push to say, we want to have, like from the top down, like our new strategy is that we are going to have officers do these random stops, quote unquote random stops, and check and search people. And there was a big push for it. And then crime in New York started to fall a lot after that. So a lot of specific rhetoric and politics was built around the idea that this stop and frisk policy was super successful, right? And that the people doing it were like heroes who were saving the city. And then when complaints came and when moves came first from judges and then from Mayor de Blasio to say, okay, we're going to stop doing this stop and frisk, there was a lot of agitation from the police, you know, morale, as you're saying, Dara, political pushback, because people were being told this thing that the previous political leadership had told you was heroism, you're now being told is bad and racist, right?
Yes.
So that's a specific political history and political context. Now, the reality is that crime has not risen in New York since they stopped this stop and frisking. It's exactly in line with what my paper would have said, which is that having the police be present is effective, but having them stop people without probable cause is not, right? And you can imagine a different city, right? Just like a different thing with like a different politics. And like you're telling the police officers, like, go out there. Like, we're going to like get out of the cars, get you out from behind your desks. You're going to walk around, be cops on the beat. You're going to stop crime. And then like crime goes down and you're like, congratulations, police. You did amazing. And we're going to hire more officers. And nobody is out there saying like, aha, what we really want to do is stop people with no probable cause, right? It's not like inherent, I think, to the task of like policing or even a police are good mentality that like the optimal thing to have police officers do is to just find young Black and Latino men who they have no basis for searching and go search them. People react poorly to that for very good reasons. Like what the cops were doing under these stop and frisk policies, it's like it's really bad and like incredibly rude and perceived that way because that's what it is. Like they were literally – like they were telling officers, like, you should just stop people and search them because you don't like the cut of their jib, you know? And like, well, and like, don't do that. Like, it's bad. People don't like it.
I mean, I think that this has to be, we have to talk about two specific paradigms in which street crime usually gets policed. One of which is the drug trade, which is tied to a lot of street crime, which is like why it's so, there's so much impact in just putting a dude at an intersection, right? Because if that's a known drug market, it's hard to get the communication around that, hey, we've moved two blocks that away to avoid the cops. And the other is gang policing, where there is a deliberate idea in theories of gang policing of collective punishment, that you want to make it so that everybody feels responsible for one person getting punished, and therefore you should be punishing members of the group for being members of the group. It's like, it's really hard to talk about it. In a vacuum, of course, it sounds like it's a dumb idea to just pull over some kid who hasn't done anything wrong. But if you think, and you're correct or you're not correct, that this kid has ties to gang members, that they're, you know, that they are at risk of gang involvement and you want to scare them straight, you know, there are lots of things that could lead you to say, yes, I understand that I'm not literally catching a guy in the act, but it's good for his future if I get him.
Sure.
Anyway.
But I mean, but there was this whole theory and rhetoric that like, well, you were going to find illegal concealed weapons, you were going to, you know, run people against their warrants, stuff like that. And like, you know, that's not crazy. You know, I think the idea that you would have some kind of net positive impact by just sort of taking people who, you know, had the wrong look and running them through the system. But it like it turns out to not work that well. People really don't like it. I think they have good reason for not liking it. Nobody wants to be stopped by the police for no good reason. It is done in a racially discriminatory manner. But like even if it wasn't, right? Like I was stopped and frisked by the NYPD one time by, I guess, somebody making a point that they could stop young white kids too. And like it sucked. I don't know. I wasn't being racially targeted, but like I was just living my life. Nobody wants that. I like to maintain some optimism though about the fact that like what police officers want to hear from politics is that the work that police officers do is valuable and important. And like I think that that is true. Right. And like is well backed up by all of this stuff. But that, I don't know, violating people's rights is not the valuable and important work that the police officers do.
Yet another Weeds episode with us not having solved, you know, turning around large, complex policy organizations.
No, we need IRS guys with like badges and stuff like that just wandering around.
We need IRS guys. Right, right.
Corporate
we need
accounting
the, we those armed IRS agents we were promised with Obamacare.
On specific, yeah. Right, right. Like in specific accounting firms, policing outside specific accounting firms that are associated with shady tax practices.
And stopping by the law firms. And like they don't need to do anything. Just like, right, no, right, I'm looking around.
Stop your first year, you know, associates at big law. Make sure that they understand that, like, future discrepancies will be a problem for them. Yeah.
All right. I like it. All right. That's great. Thanks, guys. And thanks to all of our listeners out there. I want to let you know we're going to have a special Weeds coming up on Friday. We're going to have Dave Roberts on with Ezra and Jane talking about the Green New Deal. This has been, I think, much requested in various quarters. So, you know, looking forward to hearing that as an audience member. And the Weeds will return on Friday.